Have you heard about the new MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle? The MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle is the easiest, most advanced nozzle ever, protecting you from the dangers of diesel exhaust fumes. With its patented flex magnet technology, the Pro Nozzle easily attaches with one hand from a standing position, can snap on from any angle, and fits flush to the apparatus, saving a ton of space. And MagnaGrip is the only exhaust removal system that offers a true 100% seal. For free grant assistance and to learn more, go to MagnaGrip.com.
This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tincata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tincata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tincata fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tincata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tincata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit TincataFabrics.com.
Welcome back to Main Street Firefighting, a podcast by Fire Engineering. My name is Lex Shady, and with me is my partner, Chris Tobin. Before we get started, we'd again like to thank Fire Engineering for the opportunity to talk legacy buildings, and you all for tuning in. Joining us tonight is Will Knight, a firefighter from DeKalb County, Georgia. We picked Will's brain on his thoughts and experiences with roof construction and hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks, Will, for joining us tonight. Like we discussed earlier, we're going to focus on talking about kind of legacy buildings and specifically roofs and your experience with them and kind of what you've seen throughout the fire service and kind of how they view these. Before we get started, though, can you give us a little bio and talk about your experience in the fire service?
I've been in the fire service for 16 years now. I've been with DeKalb County Fire Rescue. It's right next to the city of Atlanta. We share a very long border. I've been there for my entire career. I've spent about half of it at truck companies and about half at engines or at double houses where I might rotate between the two. I've spent some of it at really busy stations and probably a little more of it at slower or really slow houses. I'm currently at Station 21, which is on the north side of the county. It's an affluent area, and rich people don't really burn their stuff down, so I don't go to that many fires currently. That said, I have been at other companies that were running, 5,000 calls a year on an engine, things like that. So I've had a pretty wide variety of experience, but currently I'm a tillerman on Truck 21.
Can you give us a little bit of a description about DeKalb? Like, what's the culture like of the department in reference to response to fires, manpower, kind of their go-to tactics, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so DeKalb is a urban to suburban department with a little edge of kind of dipping into rural. It's a fairly large county. It's about, well, for Georgia. Not large for the rest of the country, but for Georgia, it's a large county, 270 square miles. We have 26 stations, and we get anywhere from three or four engines and a truck, plus a heavy rescue or a hazmat as manpower, to we might get four engines, three trucks. A lot of times, the initial dispatch gets added onto by companies that are close by, either in the house or coming off of other calls. So sometimes we get a little bit extra, just like anybody. Our people want to go to work. So you're usually having to fight them off with sticks anytime something sounds like it's going to be working. So that's our tactics are aggressive. The department as a whole goes to anywhere between 300 and 400 fires a year, which again, out of 26 stations, most of that's in a band across the middle of the county. And the county is shaped kind of like the state of Georgia. It's narrow at the top, wide in the middle, and gets skinny again at the bottom. So most of those fires are going to a handful of companies in two battalions. And those guys get a lot of experience in a very short period of time if you're new. And the guys that have been doing it down there for a long time are extremely good at their jobs. Where I work at on the north side, we don't get as many fires. But when we get fires, they're in a much different kind of building usually. So,
going off that last part about buildings, can you describe, I know it's a large area and you've kind of referenced this already, that it varies, but can you describe the building stock that you guys will see?
Yeah, so like I said, we go from suburban all the way up to where I'm at is much more urban. My particular territory is high-rises, commercial buildings, some single families, just a few pockets of neighborhoods that are in my territory, but most of my residential stuff is either going to be townhomes or very large center hall residential monstrosities that might be podium construction or just straight wood frame. They'll be anywhere from 4 to 6 floors, and they could be sprawling masses that you only have a little bit of the front side as your only access for aerials, and then everything else is totally inaccessible. Also, like I said, I have a bunch of high rises, but so does a lot of the county at this point now. So as you go south, it gets older and less commercially developed, a lot more residential. And so you get the old garden apartments, a lot of single family residential and stuff like that. And then your normal strip malls, big box stores, stuff like that that you see in suburbia.
What piqued your interest in building construction?
So my background in building construction really goes all the way back to my childhood. My mom still works for an engineering firm, but even as a kid, she worked for companies, civil engineering firms and other firms where she was constantly dealing with blueprints and drawings and things like that. And so we always had some of that stuff around the house. We had residential floor plan books, you know, the house plans and stuff. We had those as our bathroom reading growing up. So I was always flipping through that stuff, looking at floor plans and what they were going to be, drawings of houses and things like that. And then we also walked through a lot of stuff. My mom and I would walk through a building that was just framed up, and we would wander around and imagine what those rooms were going to be once they were completed. And so you guys do that now. When you walk through new construction, if there's no walls on it, there's no fixtures in, you have to use your imagination and use the clues that are around you to determine, okay, this is going to be master bedroom, this is going to be the kitchen, things like that. So I did that as a kid. And then around the age of 14, between 8th grade and 9th grade, my next door neighbor, he was the foreman of a framing contractor. So I started going to work with him that summer and spent that summer framing apartment buildings and scraping slabs. And a lot of what I did was just like moving stuff around and popping lines and things like that for layout. But I did swing a hammer for a while. And at age 14, you learn real quick how to do that, or you get tennis elbow. But I did that for a couple of summers, and that was a long time ago, and I've forgotten most of what I had learned. But when I came into the fire service, it gave me some context that a lot of people don't come in with. If they have never worked manual labor or skilled trade or anything like that, they don't have that. So I had something already kind of there that when I run into things now, I kind of remember how it was done. And that was, again, a long time ago, and things have changed. But that's my background as far as what got me into it and why. Probably it was already something I was interested in.
Like we talked about in the very beginning, we're going to kind of focus the rest of this discussion on roofs, in particular legacy, and at the end we'll kind of get into a little bit of the difference between the legacy and modern roofs and kind of what that means. Was there a specific incident or building that made you realize that you needed to take a deeper look at the tactics utilized in these older buildings in reference to roofs?
I don't know if there was a single building or anything like that. I've had a series of encounters where every time I find something that's not what I expected, everything that's weird, everything that's odd, or stopped me in my tracks, and that gets added to that memory bank and that list of buildings where, or incidents where I came across something that just was so different than what I thought was going to be there, what was expected. And over time those built up and kind of, pushed me in the direction of learning more, about those first, and then more about other things that could be out there second, and then eventually trying to pass that on and share that with other people so that they also have those things and start planning for the things they don't expect, so that they don't have the same kind of like momentary pause in operations when they come across something that's really odd.
Can you give an example of something you found like that, and maybe something that once you found it, you started seeing it in more places?
I don't know if I've seen it in more places each time that I run across it, but it's something where at least the principle of there could be something different sticks. And so one of the earlier ones, we were on an extended stay motel, and really, really simple vent job. We actually had two saws and two hooks on the roof. We thought that there was extension into an attic space, and we thought that attic space was a common attic all the way to a firewall in a very long, like one-story extended stay building. So we wanted to keep it from running in the attic, so we got up over that unit. It was an end unit, and I started trying to roll rafters, and I made about a four-foot head cut, that top cut, and didn't feel a single rafter. And I thought, well, I'm an idiot. I really don't know what I'm doing, and I must have zipped through like probably two or three rafters easy. And so I turned and I started coming down the slope toward the gutter, and I hit rafter, 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 and it stopped me. I just stopped completely right then and there. Nobody else was doing anything. They were all waiting on me. And for probably 10, 15, maybe 20 seconds, I don't know, time stood still. And until I figured out that the rafters weren't going from ridge to gutter, they were going the short span from unit to unit. Okay. I totally didn't expect that on a peaked roof. It was much earlier in my journey down this road, and it didn't even register that might be a thing that was going on, because we thought this was a common attic, and that wouldn't be something that would usually happen. That would happen if you had walls between each unit, and as it turns out, that's what you had. The walls in between each unit went all the way to the bottom of the decking, and then the rafters ran from wall to wall across the units. And, you know, that messed me up for just a minute, and then we rolled with it, and we got our opening and, vented it. That was one of those formative incidents that really kind of set in my mind that there's some weird stuff out there, or just different stuff that's unexpected.
Hey, so, you know, when you go around teaching and stuff, building construction, maybe not roofs specifically, but like, what's some of the big issues you're seeing when it comes to older buildings or just building construction in general, with either some training gaps or some straight up just misinformation? What's the big ones that stick out to you?
Oh man, there's so many. I mean, you could talk about, this is basically a good chunk of what I talk about whenever I teach, whether it's in my department or outside my department. A huge amount of it is dealing with myths and misinformation. And there's a lot of them. You guys teach about it too. You'll talk about some of it. A lot of us that kind of came into this subject around the same time, we all have a lot of the same thoughts and opinions on it. James Johnson is one of the best at talking about the myths and misinformation. But you know, everything from, it's mostly fear-based. That's really what it comes down to, is they all have that in common for the most part, is the myth, the misinformation. They're all based around fear and lack of knowledge, or not lack of knowledge, but incorrect knowledge, untrue things that are believed to be true. That's really what they have in common. But there's so many that would, you know, the common ones, like talking about how gusset plates fail and how soon things fail, you know, putting specific numbers on like time limits to failure, things like that, that have far too many variables to even hammer down, like, oh, you've got 3 minutes or 7 minutes or whatever in this type of building or with this construction or anything like that. There's way more going on than you could even like try to pin that down on one number. Just silly stuff like that.
Yeah, I think a lot of that comes from kind of a multiple of factors. A big one is probably like, or you know, the information age, the social media now. You know, 10, 20 years ago, or 15, 20 years ago, we had to wait for a magazine to come out, right? And that was basically how we got our pictures and what made sense and what wasn't. And now, if you say something here, you know, 5 hours from now, there could be that exact thing up online. Someone's going to get a picture of that or video up there, you know. So, I mean, everyone has smartphones, and they're, you know, so I guess the information moves a lot quicker nowadays. So I think that fact checks a lot of itself. And then also, you know, a lot of us, like you said, who came up in the fire service at a weird time in the early 2000s where everything everything was just fear-based, you know. It was, we were changing a culture, which somehow was a problem all of a sudden. That's what everything was hinged on. And then building instruction kind of got rolled into that with the lightweight stuff, because I think that was a low-hanging fruit at the time. So, yeah, all that kind of stuff now, that was 15, 20 years ago. I think a lot of us have had experience, and we're kind of basically like, well, hey, like, that was, none of that was true. You know, this is what I'm doing, and that doesn't jive. So that's, I think, where we're at, like, me and you combined, and then, you know, all the rest of us that are out there kind of, you know, maybe writing some of the wrong trains that were put there long ago. And by long ago, I mean, like, in the last, like, 30 years, tops.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's been going for 2 or 3 decades easy. Brannigan's book, when it came out, was the only thing like it. And now we've got a lot more information out there. We've got other books, other texts, and even things that aren't fire service texts that we use, you and I and Lex and all of us. And the problem is that back when that stuff started coming out, Brannigan's book was geared toward doom and gloom, and everything's going to fall and kill you. And it used case studies, which are legit things to look at. But the problem is, when we use case studies and we look at line of duty deaths and things like that, a lot of times we're not pulling the right lessons out of them. We're not really assigning the fault, not fault, fault's not a good word, but we're not assigning responsibility to the right thing or the right person or the right action or things like that. So all of that has stacked up for the last 3 or more decades and compounded. And then when you hit the internet age, the internet could be a force multiplier for good or for bad. And now we're dealing with Brandolini's law, which says that the amount of energy needed to refute BS is an order of magnitude bigger than that to produce it. So what that basically says is, if somebody puts something out there, it's so much more difficult to undo the damage from that misinformation than it is to just create it in the first place. And so it always feels like we're in a losing battle against myths and misinformation. So
that building construction group on Facebook is really good, but also really bad, because it's not really vetted well enough on who's posting what. And like you said, as soon as someone posts something that's not true, you have to spend the rest of the day trying to prove why it's not true rather than...
No, I don't have to anymore.
Right.
I used to feel like I had to.
Right, but I don't comment on it either typically, but it feels like it's like 1 step forward, 3 steps back. And it's that, so
yeah.
When people are, you know, going online looking for information, just make sure you vet where it's coming from. Or if you see something that sounds interesting, maybe send it to someone who knows a little more than you to make sure that it's accurate before you just believe it.
You know, but that's hard to do, is like you already hit on it. I mean, the books only go back so far, and we're only talking 2 or 3 authors, and some of their stuff is not correct. And if you go further back, I mean, the fire service just starts there is no fire service building instruction, you know, that far, far back. You know, it just turns into building instruction, you know, that, you know, but then it starts to diverge eventually in our time, where we had our own version of building instruction, which is nothing new, you know, by the way. It's just all building instruction in the end. But yeah, like, it is kind of hard to vet some stuff, and we're always reading backwards. No matter what we do, we can always find out where something came from, except the collapse zone. Can't find that one. I'm still searching. So if you know, let me know. I don't know where, you know, 1.5 times came from. Sounds cool. Maybe not always the case in real life. But stuff like that. Like, find out where that came from. Who made that up? You know, somebody out there somewhere started that. And I can't figure out where or when. So, I mean, that's just one example.
Yep.
So, kind of getting a little back to roofs here. What's the biggest mistake you see made with legacy roofs?
Well, define legacy roofs for me.
Typically 1940 and back would be legacy. You know, there, and that's vernaculars. I mean, this is a perfect conversation.
Wait, I was gonna say, this is a good example.
This is a perfect conversation right here. Almost nothing we do is a very precise, you know, metric, and that's one of them, you know. But I would say for the most, you have to explain some stuff to even have a conversation about building construction.
Wood frame or maybe even ordinary, things like that. So when I split up wood frame houses, buildings, semantics are actually an important part of discovery and learning and discussion, because we have to be speaking the same language, and sometimes we might argue about definitions, but that helps us actually communicate better in the end. So if you're just defining it as an age, then that doesn't really tell me what the construction is. Mm-hmm. So if you say it's something before the 40s, 50s, 60s, whenever you pick the cutoff, I don't know what that construction is. And that could be very different from region to region, or even an area in my region might be very different. Even a neighborhood might be different within that time period. Mm-hmm. So I tend to split things up by conventional and engineered or truss.
Right.
When we're talking about wood frame, we're talking about wood frame, right? That truss is massive. Or, it's you go into a church and it's got a big vaulted ceiling that's made out of heavy timber. It's the truss, but it's not lightweight.
Right.
So most of us in residential construction, we look at trusses as kind of lightweight or engineered. Mm-hmm. And then we look at conventional construction, as it's been called, for a while now, as 2x4s, 2x6s, 2x materials, and things like that. So given that, if we split it up like that based on how it's actually built, remind me what the question is again.
What's the biggest mistake you see made, like, when approaching these buildings?
Assuming that it's one or the other. I'm not sure, because generally speaking, in the context of residential construction, it doesn't make as much a difference as it might on, say, commercial buildings. It might make a huge difference which type it is. And again, assumption is probably going to be your worst enemy when it comes to approaching a building. If you assume it is one thing and it is not, it can work in two different directions. It can either set you up for failure when you thought you had extra safety, security, time, things like that, mm-hmm. or you could hold back thinking it's worse than it is, and you cut off your ability to actually get stuff done when there was that opportunity. So assumption is probably the biggest issue with most building construction in general, and it applies especially to wood frame and things like that.
Yeah, I think a lot of it falls into the latter category you're talking about, especially when we do a lot of stuff specifically for main streets or legacy areas. And that's what it is they show up to an older building, usually masonry or type 3 or 2, and they see old building equals bad, you know, when really what they should be seeing is old building equals opportunity, you know, because how overly built it is. I mean, unless there's some obvious damage or they have pre-existing information of compromised building instruction or something like that. But yeah, a lot of times it's basically they're showing up to a type 3 building and applying a type 5, you know, modern mindset to it with their operations, and they get the same outcome as you would with a lighter weight building, which is usually, you know, a complete loss and or loss of neighboring buildings, unfortunately.
So can you talk a little bit about how voids play into these fires with these buildings and kind of how that might influence the roof?
Yeah, so you're talking specifically with older building stock, conventional roofs, things like that. So in a lot of them, you have the same issues as any truss building, because the roof line is a roof line. And anytime you've got changing pitches and things like that, you can have voids. The difference is in trusses, usually you have very large open voids. Even if you can't access them, you can at least see. You got line of sight through a lot of that. The same way that the fire moves, so can your water in most cases. But in conventional construction, sometimes those voids are older, they're closed off. You have more chance, depending on the age of the building, for renovations, remodels, additions, things like that, that can create new voids or cut off old ones and make fire difficult to detect when it extends to other places. So, I mean, that's voids in general.
So the big thing about roofs that we come across the most when we do these classes is always the big bowstring truss question. Everything arched roof is a bowstring truss. And I fell into that habit for a long time. I just would call every arched roof I came across a bowstring, which, and then one day I'm like, why am I doing that? You know, I don't even know what that is on the inside of that. And then I realized how big of a problem it was, and then I realized how much I didn't know about them. And then even furthermore, it's really hard to figure out information if you want to learn that kind of stuff. There's not a lot of resources out there specifically on arched roofs. And like, what have you come across with that? This is a giant misnomer in the fire service, a massive knowledge gap with arched roofs, what you're actually looking at.
So a lot of my formative years, especially in truck work and roof work, and as I've started really digging deeper into building instruction, a lot of that training was done either alongside or under West Coast guys. So a lot of my mindset is a little more West Coast, and the Southeast is great in that we have a mixture of both East Coast kind of construction, the heavier, older stuff, and the newer, lighter stuff that the West Coast has a ton of as well. So we get to blend the best of both worlds in the way that we approach that as well. So while a lot of our truck companies may look and operate kind of like East Coast on some buildings, they're able to flex and bend to their operations to match a more West Coast style on those buildings. And so in training and learning from all these guys on the West Coast, where they actually do get on arched roofs and vent them a lot, one of the things that's really important to remember is that building construction is what allows them to do that arch into that curved shape. And that might have been a tie rod or a cable, but that made a bowstring. And that makes sense, right? A bow has a string, it's a little more flexible, and it has nothing in the middle. Somewhere along the way, that changed. And it changed, it seems like, for everybody, not just the fire service, but also engineering, architecture, the trades. All that stuff changed somewhere in that, we think, 20 years between the 30s and the 50s. And all of a sudden, everything's a bowstring. Everything curved on top is a bowstring. And most commonly, bowstring in that context refers to timber arched or steel arched trusses, because they are the most common arched roofs that you're going to find nationwide. That's what you're going to find. And the issue with that is now we have, if everything is the same, then how do we start differentiating your building construction so that you can approach it individually? If all arched roofs are just bowstrings, then what happens when we hit one that's different from another? And we get that assumption problem where we either have to assume that it is better or worse than it actually is in a lot of cases. And sometimes you guess on the side of caution, sometimes you might guess wrong, and you might be hanging your guys out to dry. So I don't use the term bowstring. I don't, it's got too much baggage attached to it. So I just call things what they actually are. And this goes into a deeper discussion about jargon, which we kind of brushed up against, but if it's timber arched truss, that's what I say. It's timber, so it paints a picture of what it's made of. It's arched, you can picture it as an arched, and then it's the truss, so you can imagine web members. And so it is very descriptive. It's specific, it's not confused with anything else, and it's as universal as it can be. And so I like that. It works for me. And when I say steel arched truss, you picture the same thing but made out of steel, you know, angle iron or angle steel, whatever. And then if I say lamella arch, that's another very specific arch design. And if I say tied arch, again, that is a very specific design that kind of gives you the idea that it's tied at the bottom, that original bowstring kind of design. Mm-hmm. So I like to differentiate everything. And that helps me, when, especially when I teach and talk about it and when we discuss operations and how you would address those individual roofs with individual operations, then that gives us that operational flexibility and safety and security. And that extends to other building construction types as well. But that's really the foundation of truck work, is the building and knowing what it's made of and then how to figure that out if you haven't in advance of the fire.
So when you were teaching, we found a lot of times people look at these arched roofs and there's the immediate fear, especially in like the older areas. So their automatic kind of tactic is, you know, no one goes in this building. It's going to come down, you know, it's bowstring, arched roof, whatever. So how do you approach that when you're teaching to kind of educate them on the construction and what their risks really are?
So usually I try to give them the background of that. So we talked about how we got to where we are in building construction based on what people did 30 years ago. Well, that's about the time that you had two major fatal fires in timber arch truss buildings. That was Waldbaum's and Hackensack. And I talk about both of those in my class sometimes. And I like to use Hackensack because there's a lot more information on it. There's three different reports on it about the building construction, about what happened. And each of them covers the event a little bit differently. So they don't all have all of the same information, but they overlap enough to where you can really kind of get a bigger picture from all three together. But even still, there's still questions that I have that aren't answered in any of those. And the problem with that, those two fires, is that you had extremely robust timber arched truss construction. And in both cases, you had fire that burned in the truss space somewhere for over 30 minutes after the fire department showed up. And then you had, in both cases, you had a single truss collapse that led to the fatalities initially. Obviously, after a truss collapse and everybody backs out, you're going to have subsequent collapses as well because the fire continues to burn unabated. Mm-hmm. But when people talk about early and unexpected failure of arched roofs, like 30 minutes is not early. Yeah. And 30 minutes is that's the warning. Like that's not unexpected. If you walk into any building and let it burn for 30 minutes after you arrive, it's going to be tough to send people in or keep people in at that point. Like that's your warning. So that's the problem, is people aren't pulling the right lessons out of that. And so people talk about building failures when really a lot of times we should be talking about operational failures. Mm-hmm. And there were discussions in those reports about some of the failures, like radio and communication failures at Hackensack and things like that. But ultimately, it's people making decisions. The building's not making any choices. The fire's not making any choices. They're following the laws of science, of physics and thermodynamics, and they're doing what they're going to do. And a lot of times, that's a predictable thing. And people did not follow that and did not predict what was going to happen correctly. And in the fire service, we tend to sugarcoat that. We tend to kind of wash it a little bit. Compare that to the military. In the military world, if you as a battlefield commander make a mistake or a series of mistakes and you get people hurt or killed or you lose a battle, your name goes down in history. You're known forever. That's not getting whitewashed. That's not getting sugarcoated. We know who General Custer was. We know when Napoleon lost at Waterloo. We know these things, and we discuss them, and we tear them apart for eons, for centuries. We're going to be talking about these battles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those leaders, they own that. They know that, and they'll lose their jobs. They will. They'll lose their reputations. They'll lose in history forever. But we don't do that. If somebody punches through a roof because they failed to sound it correctly, we say, oh, the building failed, the decking failed. Well, the person who was supposed to be sounding and didn't failed. Right. And if you spend 30 minutes putting water through a single scuttle hole in a service department while the entire truss loft is on fire, and that's all the water you get on it for 30 minutes, like that's an operational failure. If there's a man door into that truss loft and you can't get it open, that's an operational failure. And that's another thing that's in those reports. There was a door into that area where they stored all those parts, right? They had to get them all up in there in Hackensack. it was never opened. And the report doesn't say why. It's just silent. We don't know now. It's been way too long. But was it because they didn't have the right tools or the right training, or, you know, something else happened that there was, you know, already something behind the door or was locked or whatever? We don't know. But we just say, well, the building killed people. And that's the building becomes a scapegoat. That's really easy because the building doesn't fight back. The building doesn't have feelings. Nobody's reputation gets hurt by the building, things like that. So that's how we got to where we are now. That's why people fear those buildings, because of incidents like those two. And there was another one in that same era. And there have been other failures in other buildings and things like that. But those two in particular really cemented the negativity and the fear of arched roofs in the fire service.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think it just goes to say how much of a knee-jerk reaction the fire service has, and then how long that ripple can last. You know, like you said, we're going into 3 decades. You know, hopefully, I think it's starting to improve, because now, like I said, we're asking questions, and, you know, the fact that, you know, basically everything you just said is, you know, at the forefront of a lot of that. So it's not just something in a book and everyone just agrees with it anymore. It's a lot of it's getting challenged. And I think, you know, the more we get out there and say kind of like what you just said, it's going to be a wrinkle that irons itself out. It just takes time.
So earlier you referenced experiencing things on roofs that were different, and then it caused you to kind of go do some research and study and kind of learn for that in the future. Is there a book or reference material, or where did you go when you found these things to learn more about them?
So initially, a lot of my discovery probably came through hands-on classes and things like that. So Colin Kelly out of Clark County, Nevada, the Las Vegas metro area. He was an early mentor of mine. Him and the West Coast truck, or the West Coast offense, their roof class was the first one I ever took, and it's still the foundation and basis of how I operate, both the mindset, the tactics, the operations that he taught me back then. I still use those. I still pass those on. I know the history of those operations and where they came from. And that dates back from Colin, back to his mentor, Mark Carcamo, and who was a legend in LA. And LA is really, really good at roof work because they are really, really good at building construction. And so that's kind of, you know, you have to know what you're working on. Colin would talk about buildings in a way that I don't think I had heard other people talk about before, from the truck aspect, from the roof aspect. And so I kind of had to start getting better at it. I liked buildings. I already walked through them. I already knew about a little bit of it. I always liked architecture and things like that. Buildings were always cool to me, but to really start digging into it, that's probably when that journey started, was when I started getting on a truck a little more often, back in the early mid 2000s. So, as far as books go and other stuff like that, once I started reading, aside from Brannigan's, there wasn't a lot. And I forget how I came across it. I think I got on Amazon and was looking for fire service building construction books. Mm-hmm. And you always get the same one or two that would come up back then. And eventually I ran across Ching's, which is Francis D.K. Ching's Building Construction Illustrated. And Amazon had some sample pages, and I looked at it on Amazon, and I was like, man, this is awesome. This reminds me a lot of the drawings and things that I looked at a lot as a kid, because everything in there is drawn like an architectural drawing or an engineering drawing. And Ching's Building Construction Illustrated is not a fire service book. It's a architecture engineering student book, and it's a reference book. It's not meant to read like from one end to the other. But honestly, it should be for the fire service because it's all black and white. It's basically a coloring book if you wanted to be. If you haven't eaten all your crayons, that's what you could do with it. So I got Ching's. And then after Ching's, I found other books on Amazon and in old bookstores and stuff like that. And I started looking at, now I have old books from the era of my buildings. So if you want to know how your buildings were built in the 70s when they were built, then go find a carpentry book, the textbook from the trade from that era, and look at how they talk about framing from back then. And carpentry covers a huge amount of stuff. It's not just wood framing. Carpentry covers all kinds of other assembly methods and materials, all the way up to it's wild what it covers. But so that's another big one. And carpentry book is thick. That sucker is like 3 inches thick and has all kinds of pictures and details and things like that. And again, it's a reference. I'm not going to sit there and read the thing. But if I come across something in an old building, I can flip back and go, well, what does this say about that? Why did they do this? Why didn't they do something else? Why did they make this choice? If they had multiple choices available, or what was the code back then? What did it require? And that's very different from what we might require now, because materials technology have come a long way since the 60s and 70s. And so, yeah, so that's some of the reading that kind of got me pushed in that direction.
No, I think that's cool. I like that you pointed out knowing the age of your buildings and then going back and getting the specific books, because I think that's something that we run into, is that people go buy a building construction book but then don't realize that it doesn't necessarily pertain to the building they're looking at. I think there is some confusion there, so I like that you pointed that out.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the stuff, anything fire service, building construction, and the title, that's going to be a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what you probably really want to be knowing. And like I said, we've done this, we've had the same routes as you have when it comes to getting the books. I know specifically I had just recently gotten a carpentry one off Amazon from probably the, I don't know, 30s or 40s, and it was just all on roof types, basically how to frame roofs. And I want nothing to do with framing roofs, but man, it had everything I ever wanted to know about roof types. You know, awesome book for roof. It might as well just call the book Roof Types, you know, but it was a book on how to frame roofs. So like you said, that is an excellent way to find out specifically of your buildings in your area and old bookstores in your area. Like we were just out in the Pacific Northwest, and there is some older books from like the 30s or 40s in a bookstore about their buildings out in that area. Would have been awesome to grab those, you know, if you lived out there and wanted to know about, because, you know, buildings out in Washington and Oregon look totally different than buildings in Kansas, way different than buildings in Georgia, right? So people don't realize that there's this massive amount of variance. And so like you said, really get into your area, get into your old books about your old buildings, because if you're looking at a new book about old buildings, you're just basically skimming the surface. You know, that's about as far as you're going to go.
Yeah, it's really difficult to pack all of the stuff that you might want to know or might need to know in one single book. So it's not fair to even ask that. Like, yeah. If you came to Brannigan's thinking it was going to make you completely knowledgeable about all of your buildings, it can't. It was written initially in a time period that doesn't exist anymore and updated over the years, and in a region that is totally wildly different from where most of us probably work. And so some of the stuff that's in there is going to be wasted. Like, it's just, you don't have it. And some of the stuff that you have might not even be in there. And that's kind of why I like Ching's. It bridges that gap, and it's just how it's put together. Like, Ching's doesn't approach it from a collapse kind of narrative or have discussions on specific incidents and how things went wrong. It just tells you how it's put together. And for me, that is more useful, because if I know how it's put together, I can tell reasonably in most cases how it's going to come apart. If I know the materials and the method that something uses or used in the past to be built, I have an idea of how it's going to behave on the fire ground. I don't need somebody to tell me how this particular incident went and have a whole bunch of those stories in a book to kind of scare me about a building construction type or a particular building. I can make those decisions on my own based on my training, my experience, things like that. I can decide if a building is something I want to be a little more nervous about, or if it's something that I can be fairly confident in.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah, I think Jason Bresler hits on that a lot with, you know, the fire service does a bad job of telling us about the good times, right? If we just focus on all the bad, then everything looks bad and everything is scary, because we don't even acknowledge, you know, or have anything to point towards a confidence marker, you know, in history, if all we do is dwell on the bad stuff, which is, you know, when we do these classes and we walk around these old main streets and stuff, yeah, I mean, we try to say, hey, you know, look at this building, but don't look at it from a red flag perspective. Look at it for, like, what you can do, what can get done, you know. And so I guess it's context is a big deal, like with what you're saying, that matters. But also, it only goes so far, you know, in the book world, right? Like, you can only learn so much from a book in front of you. And then you can only also learn so much walking through a building that hasn't been on fire yet, or just a building in general, because everything's covered, you know, in one way or another. So, I mean, in your opinion, other than doing like what James Johnson does, which is go out and like frame a building out with a class, which I think is probably the best thing ever. Unfortunately, with the price of stuff now, I think that's probably never going to happen again. But other than that, like, what is in your opinion the best way to get a well-rounded, holistic? I'm talking like Fire Academy, you know, building construction. Well, what's the best methodology, do you think?
Well, you kind of just said it. I mean, you got to hit it from a bunch of different angles. So you've got to have a little bit of foundation laid down. You've got to get the basic building construction types, and then you've got to start paring that away forcefully, because that stuff's very static and buildings don't fit nice and pretty in the five types all the time. And so then you've got to get out and actually see it. You got to see how things are built. And then when you see some stuff, you got to go back and go, well, what was this thing I saw? You know, figure out what it was named, how that's built. Are there brands? Are there different ways of doing that same thing? If you see I-joists, are all I-joists the same from every brand? Or if one brand does something a little bit different, why do they do it different? And if they allow something different, different manufacturers of different materials will allow different things in their material that other people won't. And that's like, at that point, you're really kind of getting, you're going from, as James Johnson says, from need to know to nice to know to nerd to know. And that's where, you know, obviously we all exist right here in this conversation, but everybody needs to get there a little bit every now and then. The need to know is great. That's the entry level stuff. Nice to know happens. That just happens along the way, happens from calls, having fires, things like that. The nerd to know is what happens when people start to get interested in learning and really deeply understanding. That's when people are buying books. That's when people are intentionally doing walkthroughs and really taking pictures and going back and figuring out what something was that they didn't recognize, or reading ahead of time and then noticing it the next time they go out. Oh, I didn't notice that before, but this time I did because I saw a picture of it in a book or a description of it on an article or something like that. And that's happened to me. I run across things every now and then that either I don't know what they are, or I know what they are, but I've never seen it in real life. Those two things happen periodically as well. So that's a fun thing. And man, if you don't get outside of your area and walk other people's buildings, not just your territory or your county or your city, but get outside elsewhere in the country, start in your state, I guess, and walk other buildings, learn other places. It makes you better at picking that stuff up back home.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, that was a big, you know, we never flew, you know, we always drove and made it a point to stop in towns on the way to, like you said, hone in on your visual cues and to pick up on the variances. So, you just don't get, you know, I guess, I don't know what psychological term you would call that, but just, I guess, blinded by your own stuff in a vacuum, essentially. So yeah, anywhere we go, we always dedicate time to doing exactly what you just said and to get an eye for different areas.
Well, if you think about how we teach kids to read, we give them progressively harder reading levels, right? Mm-hmm. They start out in the entry stuff, they learn sight words, and they get the very simple books. And then as they go, they get harder and harder books, and they get into, you know, advanced reader programs, things like that. And then we have grade levels, like, oh, my fourth grader reads at a seventh grade reading level. And you give them more challenging books to continue to advance that. It's the same with building construction. If all you look at is, if all you read is the same book all the time, you don't really get better. You might get faster or, you know, whatever, but that same book is not going to make you a better reader. You're not challenging yourself to understand more or more difficult. So it's the same with building construction. You have to get outside of what you normally see, what you normally know, and start learning other things as well and challenging yourself to figure those things out. And then that makes you better when you come back and deal with the simple at-home stuff.
And I think it makes you more able to adapt when, like you said earlier, you come across something, you see something all the time, and all of a sudden you see something different. If you've never gone out and seen other buildings, you're not going to have the ability to adapt quickly to that. But if you've practiced that and you've seen other stuff, you're going to have knowledge in the background of your mind to be able to adapt to the new situation.
Absolutely. So, you know, Kyle Samsing and a bunch of other guys talk about the OODA loop and that recognition of the problem. Mm-hmm. And then some people will describe it almost like a Rolodex, which the kids these days won't understand. But Rolodex, the file card system where you're cycling through a whole bunch of stored memories mm-hmm. until you hit the one that has the closest context to what you've got. And at that point, your brain starts to latch onto it and make a decision and move toward a solution. Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't have any of those, you don't have any file cards, you don't have any references, it becomes very difficult. And your brain will sometimes just cycle, just recycle and recycle and recycle. And that really delays. That's what happened to me on that extended stay. On the Nights Inn, mm-hmm. I recycled for a while. I mean, longer than I should have. Mm-hmm. And the next time I came across something that was weird, I probably recycled again. But if I come across something that is similar or similar to something I've seen, something I know can exist, or I know just some general principles about things that might be able to exist out there, then the first time I encounter that, I don't recycle for as long. I don't go through that Rolodex system for as long. So it speeds up decision-making, speeds up operations, keeps things flowing nice and smooth. And yeah, like you said, the way that you build that memory bank, that filing card register, is through actually going out and seeing things. And the more variety you can get, the more different memories and concepts and things like that you've got stored in there to refer to.
Yeah, I think that two things definitely stuck out to me from going to all the different areas that we've been to and doing the classes and just doing deliberately traveling to just pulling off the exit to a small town and, you know, being, hey, let's check out this town and see what this town looks like. Two things have basically I've noticed from doing that is one, you definitely notice the endemic characteristic of a town. There's a signature in every single town we go to or do a class. I can find something that probably that whoever built that town, it was probably during the same amount, you know, 40 or 50 year era that I'm talking, like the Main Street. The architects had something they did just there that doesn't really exist outside that county. And you start seeing the small little things like that, whether it's the foundations, how they laid, there's certain things they did with the brickwork, the dentals, stuff like that, that I can tell are like, hey, that's weird. You know, I've never seen it anywhere else but here. You know, why are all these buildings like that? You know, so that kind of stuff you start picking out. And then, like Greg Redman had alluded to one other time, you start seeing patterns. So you see it in movies now, like we'll be watching a movie and you see an old building or something, I'd be like, I bet I know where they're filming this at, because you start noticing roof slopes and just different things about the old buildings. You know, you can start categorizing it. Well, that's probably a northeast, you know, building type construction. You know, that's probably maybe that's up in the Great Plains, or that's definitely out west. You know, that kind of stuff you pick up on. So those two things, for sure, I've developed from just, like you said, deliberately going out and trying to learn more just by looking at buildings. Yep. So,
and another thing is, as our buildings age and they build new ones, sometimes they tear down the old ones, but a lot of times they just develop new areas and they bring in new technology and things like that. And that stuff didn't always start right there where you're at. Right. It might've started somewhere else. So, the specific example I talk about in class sometimes is, panelized roofs. We don't have panelized roofs on the East Coast. As far as I know, I haven't found anybody who has one east of Texas. There's one in the DFW area that somebody told me about. There's some in the Rockies area. But for the most part, panelized roofs are a West Coast thing. And I don't know why. I don't know why it hasn't spread, but one day it will. And so I look at other people's buildings, because even if I don't have one now, I might have one later. Or somebody that follows my career after me, like when I'm gone, they might get one. So it might take another 15, 20 years for panelization to hit the Atlanta area. But I'll be darned if I'm going to let people that work around me that are still going to be here then go through their career without any idea that this is possible. Because after I'm gone, they're going to run across it and they're not going to know what to do with it. They'll never have seen it. They'll never have heard of it. So I like to find things that are elsewhere and let people know that it's out there, because one day it might be in here where we're at.
So that kind of leads to the next question. When you're working with a newer member, or maybe just someone that's like new to truck work in general, what do you focus on as the most important for them to know in relation to building construction, and maybe particularly in relation to roofs? You know, what is the first things, like you're like, hey, bud, you're new this morning, we catch a fire later, this is what I want you to know.
Oh man, there's no one thing. It's not, it takes a pretty broad little foundation. It doesn't have to be deep, but it has to be wide, right? So initially people need that, like we said, the five types. They got to know generally what the categories are and what the strengths and weaknesses of those categories are. You know, what are the materials and how do they go together? That's the basics. And if you kind of get a grasp on that, we can work with it, because that tells you a lot about a building. For the most part, when we're on the roof in my area, we're less concerned with walls. We know that walls, columns, things like that are going to be sturdy for us. If you work in a lot of type 3, a lot of old masonry stuff in certain parts of the country, that's not the case. You might actually focus a lot on the walls, because the walls carry an inordinate amount of the building. And a wall failure is a possibility, and it is catastrophic. For me, in my area, that is much less an issue, unless we're talking about tilt-up big box stores, and in which case walls become a very big concern again. But for the most part, when we're talking about wood frame, because that's what the predominant type of construction is in my territory, or my department, where we have most of our fires, I'm not concerned about wall failures, because there's a lot of backup for walls. And in type twos, I'm not really concerned with wall failures for the most part, unless it's a tilt up. So if we have a strip wall, I'm more worried about roof decking and roof trusses or whatever the roof supports. If we're in a house or an apartment, I'm primarily concerned with decking. I want people to be able to sound really, really, really well, but sounding also needs a lot of training. Needs a lot, again, that Rolodex, that reference bank has to be kind of broad. So that's difficult if you're brand new or brand new to a company and you don't have any of those things. You're probably not going to carry a lot of responsibility for how the operation goes anyways. So I don't need you to know all of that right away. It's going to be the most experienced member that's going to be sounding and leading everything, because they're going to be the one with that widest, broadest knowledge of the most different things that you could come across. And they're going to be calling the shots on where we go and how we get there and what we're going to do when we get there. And that, again, follows kind of a West Coast LA style pattern, where the AO actually runs the roof operation, the driver, the senior man, and then the officer kind of manages the roof division if he's by himself, or interfaces with other officers and deals with the a little more of the administrative type stuff. So and now in my department, I don't have that kind of staffing. So my officer may be the one also cutting, or he may be the one, if he's the most senior, he may be having to pull all the work, may have to be hooking everything while somebody else is cutting. But whatever it is, I don't need a brand new person to know all that much. I just need them to know the operation, the cut sequence, and that you can teach that to a monkey. So they just need to know the footwork and the choreography. Okay. Kind of like if you were brand new to a football team. Mm-hmm. I don't need you to be Peyton Manning. I need you to know your position and how the play goes, and then what the audibles are. That's all I need you to do. Can you run? Can you follow the play? That's it. So kind of, that's kind of how it goes for brand new people. But we also I'm at a double house where, and on a tiller, we don't end up with brand new people on the truck, really, like ever.
So that was going to be my next question, is the people that end up on the truck, I'm assuming they've had some years of experience.
Not universally. That would be great if we had the kind of staffing where we could do that. It's only that way on my truck because it's a tiller, which means I have two drivers and an officer. So we never have four people on any truck really in the county. Our staffing, like a lot of people right now, is very short. So we will put warm bodies on the tailboard of anything, including trucks. But I don't really have a tailboard position because we have three-man staffing. So, some of the busier trucks down south, like Truck 16, Quint 24, they'll get inexperienced members, and they could be assigned the roof for any truck task with a brand-new probationary individual. But that's just the way it goes this day and age.
Right. So do you guys focus, I'm assuming most of your stuff is on-the-job training when you're talking about developing those roof skills, but do you have the ability to get into like acquired buildings and do some roof work up there too, or is it mostly just, like I said, on-the-job fires?
Acquired buildings are fairly rare for us. We don't have a program that kind of just fall in our lap every now and then, and sometimes we make the most of it. Sometimes not everybody gets a shot at the stuff. Here recently we had a whole string of buildings down one street that we got to send the entire department through. We may still be using them, I'm not sure, but we had several months that we got to put everybody that wanted to go through all kinds of stuff. And they worked through, depending on what shift and what station, battalion and things like that, they did different things. But we got to get our rookie up on that roof and show her what she's looking for, what she's feeling. And she got to get several different roofs because these old war era, this was duplex housing when the airport that's in our county was an airfield, an Army airfield, and or Naval Air Station, I can't remember. But either way, it was base housing. And so they're built way, way different than anything else in the county. And when we got up there and found three layers of decking, the rafters are 4x6s, like some weird number, like almost 36 inches on center. That's just odd. The walls in some cases come all the way to the roof, and they're like 4 inches away from the 4x6s. So you'll roll a rafter and then hit a wall, and it feels like you're hitting another rafter, and it's very confusing. It's odd. So that was cool to show her, hey, this is an oddity. This is a weird thing. Also, here's the difference in sounding. You sound over the main roof and then sound over the carport. And the carport was just a single layer of OSB over 2x6s. Way different. That's more common. That's really what we deal with more often on conventional construction. So, yeah, we did get recently get a chance, but it's not that common.
Well, thank you for your time. I think this was really informative. If people have more questions, is there a way that they can reach out to you? Or I know you mentioned your podcast. You want to kind of tell them where they can find that information if they want more roof stuff?
So I'm part of the Roof Perv, which is mostly on Facebook. We have an Instagram account, but I don't think anybody really posts on it. So, but on Facebook, the Roof Perv, that's me, James Johnson, Rob Fisher, Steven Tyler, and we just added Barry Frankie, who is awesome. He's out of San Jose. So the five of us, we occasionally get together and do podcasts. We also occasionally just post on there when somebody finds something that they are interested in and want to post about. They might write a short or long post. We also field some questions from time to time. People send us messages. We try to get back and answer them. So you can reach out to all of us through the Roof Perf page on Facebook.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Will. We really appreciate your time, and take care.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of Main Street Firefighting, a podcast by Fire Engineering. We hope it was worth your time. As always, if you have a topic you'd like to discuss or an interesting fire in your area, please reach out. Until then, stay safe and have a good night.